Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host for this show as we continue to update you on the coronavirus in our area, including the latest on testing and treatment. This evening, I'm joined by our guest, Dr. Van Cherry, who's chief of LSU Health, Shreveport Department of Pediatrics Infectious Disease Section, and also the current president of Louisiana Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. We're also joined by Dr. Andrew Jurochko, professor and Carol Feist Endowed Chair of Viral Oncology and the Department Vice Chair of Microbiology and Immunology. Welcome, docs.
Welcome. Thank you.
You can participate, listeners, with your questions or comments by calling 1-800-552-8502. Let's start with some local statistics. Our neighbor, Texas, has been reporting well over 8,000 new cases a day, even though that is down a bit from previous numbers. The positivity rate of testing is 15.5%. So what is Louisiana's positivity rate as a state, and what's our positivity rate locally?
So, locally, we've been in similar to Louisiana. Louisiana has been similar to Texas. We were looking actually just today at several parishes nearby, and they're all in the low double digits. If you think of Bossier, Caddo, and DeSoto as examples, and it's not dissimilar to what we're seeing in Texas.
Okay. And what about like places down in New Orleans? How are they doing? They were a big hotspot.
They were. I mean, as far as LDH is concerned, the entire state is red, considering it has it classified as high levels of viral spread within almost all 64 of the parishes. So obviously some have a little higher, some have a little lower, but for the most part in the larger urban areas, the numbers are still pretty high, again, similar to what we see in Texas.
Okay, and now we spiked initially and then we've got a second spike. Our death rate, it seemed, or mortality rate, initially seemed a little on the high side relative to other parts of the country. But now it seems like it's coming down. Is that a function of testing, or are we actually doing better with treatment?
So the treatment side of things has changed a lot. We've learned a tremendous amount over the past four or five months, and best practices about how to treat patients. Early on, we were intubating patients very quickly to take over their lung function, and what we've learned, and the critical care doctors can address this the best, is that early intubation is actually probably not the best strategy. If you can avoid intubation, patients are better off. We also know a lot more about how the virus is affecting the whole body in terms of these micro blood clots and ways to prevent that, which prevents the downstream effects. So we have really come a long ways in terms of our supportive care of patients. In terms of antivirus medications to specifically treat this virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, we've come a little ways. And we talk a lot about remdesivir, which is what we call a direct-acting antiviral. It works on the virus itself to shut it down. And its benefit in hospitalized patients is considered modest. It's not a gangbuster of a drug, but it has a modest benefit of reducing the length of hospitalization.
Okay, and what value do you think increased testing has had in terms of whether, say, choosing appropriate treatment or just in terms of how the disease is being managed overall?
Well, I mean, obviously in the context of testing, and John has been instrumental in outreach to the nursing homes that our lab tests at. But, in a broad sense, as soon as you know someone's positive, obviously it's easier for them to decide to seek medical help, regardless of what that is, as opposed to, when it first started and people didn't even know what they had. So I think that has gone a long way, of course, to just the knowledge that you're positive and that you need, if you are having difficulty breathing or anything else, to go seek medical attention, which clearly was not happening early in the process.
And also, Sandy, we learned that not everybody presents with, say, a stuffy nose or fever, that there's a broad spectrum of presenting symptoms. And for some people, it's just they have headaches, and they usually don't have headaches, and they think it's a sinus headache, for instance, and they may not have fever. Yeah. Or other people have GI manifestations and diarrhea and nausea as the only presenting symptom initially.
So if someone has a GI symptom and you do a nasal swab, is that going to pick it up as accurately as if you had, let's say, upper respiratory symptoms?
Good question. It probably will, because where the virus resides, its primary location is in the back of the throat and the back of the nose. So you don't have to do a fecal swab or something like that to detect it. You really want to go to the hottest source of it. And the GI manifestations aren't so much because of the virus itself attacking the intestines, but it's because of your immune response that is causing inflammation, and that's what facilitates and causes diarrhea.
Got it. And most of the virus that you would find in stool or waste is actually virus that simply has gone down the back of the throat, is draining sinus, and so. That's the wastewater idea. But yes, and there's absolutely no evidence that I'm aware of that the different aspects of whether you have GI or headache or anything else is would change where the virus is or have anything to do with the ability to detect it in nasal pharyngeal swab, for example.
So there's just a variable presentation of symptoms, which I would think would make it that much tougher to diagnose in the absence of a test, because you could have anything potentially.
It's true. It does make it more difficult because the symptoms we're talking about are very nonspecific, right? Think about flu. And I always like to use flu as a comparison because most people are familiar with it. So in the middle of flu season, if an adult has a runny nose, a cough, sore throat, and fever, You don't even need to do a test because they've got flu. And so you may go ahead and initiate a treatment like Tamiflu, for instance, based on those clinical symptoms without a test because you can make that diagnosis accurately. With the COVID virus, we're still learning. But those varying presentations are still very nonspecific. And so the patient who thinks they have a sinus infection, it could be, but it also could be COVID.
And that's where testing really helps.
It helps us define, is this person a risk to other people because it's truly COVID, or can they just continue working and take antibiotics for a sinus infection?
Yeah. So you mentioned, that really gets back
to the first question you asked, right, about how testing has helped us diagnose not just the fact that you test and can identify someone, but it eliminates these non-specific symptoms as being something someone might ignore, but allows us now to identify that person A or person B actually has the virus, and that regardless of the constellation of symptoms, they may need to seek help. And so that's been a real, a game changer for a lot of the areas that have a robust testing plan.
So if you, let's say, test positive for the regular flu, that doesn't necessarily exclude co-infection with COVID-19.
Correct.
Now, you mentioned Tamiflu. Is it fair to assume that Tamiflu would not work against the COVID virus?
Correct. It will have no effect against the COVID virus.
So then if somebody's having symptoms and a regular flu test can't exclude the presence of COVID-19, then should they have both tests performed? So that's exactly what we're going to do.
We're setting up a multiplex assay in our EVT lab to do flu A, flu B, and the coronavirus in one test. So anyone coming into our lab starting probably sometime in September, we're starting to validate it almost as soon as we can get the kit. And we'll be able to give you come in for a test. You'll know flu A, flu B, and the coronavirus all at one time. So that will eliminate the issue that you just pointed out. And that's in the works and will be ready for the fall.
So you, getting back to the traditional seasonal flu, one of my coworkers actually and I were having a conversation today regarding the similarities and differences between the seasonal flu and the coronavirus. And so one of the things I've been hearing from people, both locally and in the national arena, is that with the additional testing that is being performed, that we're picking up a lot of asymptomatic folks or people who had mild symptoms who, back when the disease first presented, were told, if you're not severe, just stay home. And so perhaps we had a more exaggerated impression of how severe the disease was because we weren't seeing the milder symptoms that people were presenting with and weren't coming in. So the argument that some people are making is, is this any worse than the seasonal flu in terms of number of people who die or the mortality rate? And so is this, you know, what makes the coronavirus more worrisome than the regular flu?
So, well, there's sort of, John, you wanted to do the clinical aspect?
Yeah, sure.
I was going to do the numbers.
Yeah. Well, I'll actually start with the numbers. And I would say that this virus is about 10 times worse than seasonal flu. And Andrew's going to correct me, and maybe it's 8.9 or somewhere like that. But
no, that's the going rate, and, yeah, and you're exactly correct. I mean, we have 160,000 deaths at this point in what, 5 months, and the average flu is 35,000 to 40,000. So we're already four times in 5 months versus 12 months. So that right, yeah, there tells you, gives you an indication of the significance and the higher case fatality rate. So, yeah, absolutely right on spot.
Yeah. And I think what we're also seeing is that, you know, now we had our first peak, we flattened the curve, people relaxed and started going out, and our rates go up. And now we're flattening the curve again, especially when you look at the data on hospitalizations, ventilator use. But really, hospitalizations are the best indicator because the ventilator use has changed with change in practice. Our test rates are still, positivity rates are still going up. That's better. And so we know we can flatten the curve with the mitigation strategies we've been doing, masks, social distancing, hand sanitizers, and the like. It's the simple things that are going to make the biggest difference. Yeah.
Dr. Vancheri, as a clinician, do you worry that with the increase in hospitalizations with the coronavirus, that resources would be redirected to those patients and away from patients who otherwise would be getting care for unrelated things like strokes and heart attacks and other severe conditions, and that perhaps as a result there'd be an increase in the fatality rates from those other conditions that under normal circumstances you wouldn't see?
I think that's a possibility. I think what the numbers are showing us is that not all deaths that are occurring now with a negative COVID test are unrelated to COVID. That is to say, COVID stresses the body. And so a person may have a stroke in their recovery period after COVID, or they may have a heart attack because the stress of COVID virus kind of tipped them over the edge. And that happens with flu, that happens with other illnesses as well. And so not all of the deaths that are occurring are solely explained by COVID direct pathology. Some of it is the extra stress causing these other issues.
But in the context of the cancer center, I mean, what your question is very valid. There's a lot of data out there that, you know, patients with various cancers are do much worse because of the virus. People are delaying treatments and things. So there is a lot going on with this, with the pandemic that is affecting to get to your point, you know, other people with other diseases. And there's a lot of data out there. I know in various cancer centers that very clearly show those numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. So I practice, I'm an oncologist at Willis Knighton here in town, and we participated in a multi-institutional study, registry trial that basically looked at this. It was recently published in The Lancet, and as you said, Dr. Rochko, it demonstrated clearly that that there were increased risk mortality in cancer patients who contracted the coronavirus. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Now, Governor John Bel Edwards said that Louisiana will remain in phase two for a few more weeks. So what would it take for us to get out of phase two, and what would it take for us to end up back in phase one?
I mean, if you look at it, it is complicated. I mean, our numbers are trending generally in the correct direction for the next phase. There's more down arrows and all in the 64 parishes and up arrows other than down south and a couple other ones, but we're not anywhere near what needs to be really for a wide open. I mean, we were talking almost every parish has 10% or greater numbers of community spread. That's not a positive trait for really any widespread opening. I mean, when they shut down in March, we had probably 1 in 1,000, somewhere in that range. We're talking now 1 in 10 in most parishes. So it tells you where we are now versus 5 months ago.
With those kind of numbers, I mean, is contact tracing even feasible?
Probably not.
No.
When you have a lot of disease out there, you really can't do true contact tracing. I mean, we've been dealing with syphilis in our area for decades.
The other nine will be watching the one.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we're talking a bunch about testing. Dr. Yurochko, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the Emerging Viral Threat Lab at LSU, what it does and what makes it so special?
So the EVT lab was started in March, and it's been running since then. We are set up as a reference lab. We're part of LSU, and our mission as the state school is to go out. We work with Dr. Vancheri very closely. He's a member of the EVT lab. We've been doing most of Region 7, looking at nursing homes, community outreach. We have Dr. Vancheri and his team, a strike team, going to many nursing homes and other federally qualified health centers. We have repurposed our cancer center vans to go out and do community service. We obviously do elements of our own school for faculty and staff. We are exploring the possibility of doing colleges, and hopefully, if we have a sufficient testing capacity, even do K through 12, although at this point it's truly exploratory. We've run over 60,000 tests since it started, and we're ramping up to hopefully hit about 7, 8, maybe 1,000 a week. And we're hoping with some new machines that to come in to ramp up even more. We have a lab established by the professors and faculty here in microbiology. Dr. Vancheri in pediatrics has helped. We had a lot of help from the Cancer Center with their CLIA certified lab to get our feet wet early on to make sure we had all appropriate approvals as we started. And we do most of the diagnostic testing for community outreach in Region 7, so Northwest Louisiana. We branched out a little bit to the other Region 6, which is Northeast and parts of Central Region 6. We do diagnostic testing for the actual genome presence of the virus. We also do serology, so for presence of a past infection. That pretty much covers where we're at right now. I think one of the things you asked why I think we're so special, I think we're very adaptable. As scientists who originally set this up, we were able to establish a lab that didn't have supply chain issues. So you look at a lot of the diagnostic labs are struggling with reagents because they picked a certain machine that only has a certain supply chain. We decided, much like our own research labs, we could use any supply, so to speak, to get it to work. So we have not had as many supply chain issues as other labs. We're flexible when new technologies have come out. We've tried to adapt them to speed up and improve our workflow.
What about looking at specific aspects of the virus, like mutations?
Yeah. So we actually have a brand new machine that was installed this week, which will, in fact, allow us to look at mutations in the virus should things change in anywhere in northwest Louisiana. So we will be prepared for any changes coming from probably online sometime next week. So pretty much August through on, we'll be able to detect that.
Now, you mentioned serology. That's essentially looking at the blood for antibodies as evidence of a previous infection. Where would that be helpful? How is the information helpful, and when would it be appropriate to test somebody to see if they were previously infected?
So in our case, our interest is if we want to test, obviously you could test any physician who was in there where they had a test that would, again, in theory, they would know any of our staff that they've been previously infected. Some of it's obviously information. For us, where we've been using it a lot is with our LifeShare for convalescent serum. When a donor comes in, we can test what their titer is. We have a quantitative test. So whether that serum is going to be good for convalescent plasma therapy, we're also going to use it if we start doing outreach to schools. We can tell if a student has been already tested positive. They do not want to be someone we want to be in a surveillance study, for example, because they probably would not in the course of a surveillance study would not likely show evidence of a current viral infection. I'm not sure yet we can use it as an immune certificate, but it's at least an example as our assay is very efficient. It has a high sensitivity, high selectivity. And so we feel very confident if someone comes in, at least they know they've had a positive infection. But like I said, our use is going to be in diagnostics for surveillance studies. We can test as well as for the convalescent plasma therapy.
So there are a number of places to get tests. Some of the tests, unfortunately, still take 7 to 10 days, it seems. Is there a particular reason why some places take longer than others? Are there different tests? I mean, how does someone decide if they want to get tested, where would be the best place to go?
You know, unfortunately, we don't anyone just can't go in for an easy test. There's still drive-throughs, and I get asked this question a lot. And our current format, we try to have a 48-hour turnaround as the best of our ability. We try to do 48, 72 hours. We can do it oftentimes under 24 for emergency ones if necessary. But like I said, most are 48, 72. I think the reasons many tests are longer, they have to send those tests out. So you go to one of the pharmacies here, you get screened. Those tests get sent out. They're not done locally. I suspect a lot of those places are overloaded. As Dr. Van Cherry knows, we try to never have more than a one-day backlog of samples so that on Sunday, if samples come in, we can run them Monday, bright and early Monday morning. We don't, and so we understand our limits and try not to go over them, where I think some of the labs probably through no fault of their own, they're just overloaded and they just, it's, as you know, we've seen 7 to 14 days, which sadly ends up making a useless test because it's too late by then. Right. So
how does someone get your test?
For us, if you look on our EVT website or you contact us via email, there's an EVT email. We have 2 to 3 days every week. We have an outreach. Any citizen of Louisiana can go to any of these community outreach centers and get tested. They're drive-through tested. We have various personnel there, obviously in all appropriate PPE, talented, doing swabs safely for the citizen, safely for the person doing the test. And we will get you those answers back. Now, I just want to remember, we're a reference lab. So if you go there through one of those, there is a health center that in essence serves as the physician of record, and we release the data to them, and you would have to contact them. And the reason I say that, we get a lot of people contacting, asking if we can release the results, and we legally cannot release the results. We release it to the physician at the health center. But any citizen who has symptoms or is otherwise worried with an exposure can know that we have two or three every week community testing sites around the city of Shreveport or Caddo Parish that they can go to, and that will come to our EVT lab.
Very good. Dr. Vancheri, let me ask you, it seems to me that if the majority of people who are infected with the coronavirus will have, let's say, mild to moderate symptoms that do not require hospitalization, and clearly if they had severe symptoms, they would know to go to the hospital. So it seems to me that and since they're at home, there's very limited treatments other than supportive care. It would seem to me that the real value of testing would be for someone to say, okay, I'm positive. I need to isolate myself, not go to work, not expose other people, certainly not be around vulnerable people. So it seems that it's something that one would do to protect other people, and certainly in the back of their mind, keep in mind, hey, if I'm getting worse, let's not wait. But do you think that that's actually happening? That when people do test positive, that there's a change in behavior, and why should that behavior really be any different than what we should be doing if we're not sick?
So we've learned a couple of important things, Dr. Katz. One is that many people, before they have symptoms, have the highest viral levels, right? So think about that again. So for the first 2-3 days, the virus is replicating in the nose, the patient is not having any symptoms, and they're very good at spreading these high levels of virus. And so that tells us, if you wait till you have symptoms, the horse is already out of the barn, right?
So we should test asymptomatic people?
Asymptomatic shedding is the biggest, yeah. And we're seeing that in our nursing homes in particular. We've learned that where in a nursing home, they may have 5 people who are symptomatic on a Monday. And when our teams come in on Thursday and test everybody, 35 or 40 people are positive, many of them asymptomatic. And it's that asymptomatic, or really, for most people, pre-symptomatic period, that it makes this virus so difficult.
So that brings me to the question of children and schools. Mm-hmm. There was a camp, or was there a, yep, or is there was a school where they basically camp tested, or I think maybe it was camp. They tested.
It was a camp.
It was a camp, yeah. They tested these kids before they came. And, they weren't there, and they were, I guess, all negative. And then it wasn't very long before they had widespread infection of the disease. So, if you are, and presumably they were asymptomatic when they were tested. So, what do you think, we learn from that?
So 2 things are at play here. One is that the test has a false negative rate that we don't really think about except for scientists and nerds like me. Okay. So what that means is there are a lot of reasons the test can be negative, even though the patient's infected with the virus. So number one, it's too early. So if I get exposed today and I go test tomorrow, it's going to be negative. It takes a few days for the virus to start growing and spreading in my system before the test becomes positive. And so the optimal timing after an exposure is somewhere around 5 to 7 days, even if the patient's not having symptoms, okay? So that's number one. The other thing is that a lot of testing that occurs may be done inappropriately. So if you just swab the very front of your nose, that's not an accurate place to test in the body. You have to test deep in the nose or all the way through the nose to the back of the throat, okay? And if you just swab the front, the test is going to be negative, even if there's virus in the back of your throat most of the time, okay?
And there are lots of other reasons that tests can be negative, even though the patient is sick with the virus, okay? So that's number one. And number two, with respect to the camps, and think about it for schools, is some people say, well, why don't we just test all the kids before they start school? Well, that gives you a single snapshot in time. On maybe one day, we test all 40,000 people in Caddo and 20,000 in Bossier kids, and we have a snapshot in time. But many of those are going to fall into that period where they're already infected, but they're not far enough along to detect on the test. So they're going to have a false negative, and they're going to develop symptoms, and they're going to spread virus until they become symptomatic or other people get the virus. So that's the big challenge with this. And that's why we go back to kind of social contract theory and the importance of quarantining if you're sick. If you've been exposed, you should limit your contacts. You should wear a mask. It's not about, you know, restricting your liberties, really, about to wear a mask. It's about protecting the people you love. And it's about being responsible in not spreading the virus, not taxing our healthcare system with people who can be, you can avoid the infection, and we should avoid it.
So, you know, there seems to be this impression that children are resistant to the virus or have a milder course and a lower mortality rate. And I've even heard it stated that children may even be immune. Obviously, that's not true.
Well, I mean, there are several things there. It's true they have a lower case fatality rate. It's very rare to see children die of COVID-19.
But they're not immune.
But they may have some cross protection from other coronaviruses that they see more frequently. Common cold viruses in the coronavirus family may give some cell-mediated cross-protection. And that's Dr. Urochko's area of expertise in viral immunology. We are seeing the complication that is rare, but it's called multi-organ inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC. And that's a rare complication. We're talking about one in 10,000 children. It's rarely fatal, but it is a severe disease. And we've seen several cases of that in Northwest Louisiana already. So there are reasons to be concerned. And there is conflicting data about whether kids transmit efficiently. And the data coming out of Korea and the transmission study in homes showed us that kids transmit much less than teenagers and adults. But more recent data here says that kids may have a higher amount of virus in their nose. But we have to remember that more virus doesn't necessarily mean it's more transmissible, because kids don't cough as forcefully as adults, and they're just different physiologic factors like that.
Well, you know, Israel had a spike back in April. They seemed to get their numbers down pretty low, I think, by May, and then sent kids back to school. And then by August, they had another spike that seemed like 2.5 to 3 times as high as it was from when back in April. Mm-hmm. And that was, I mean, do you think that there was an association from sending the kids back to school? And what can we learn from that? And how do we apply that information here?
Yeah, so I don't know what the circumstances of sending those kids back to school. Were they wearing masks? What kind of distancing were they able to implement, and hand hygiene and all of those things. When those three mitigation factors are in place, the risk of spread between kids and from kids should be relatively low. Masks are very, very effective at preventing infection and transmission.
Got it. Okay, let's move on to treatment. You know, let's get a status update. What is the current status as of today, August 6, 2020, regarding hydroxychloroquine?
So the most recent data that came out yesterday in the New England Journal was a study asking the question, can hydroxychloroquine prevent infection in people who've been exposed in a high-risk exposure? And the answer was no. So it fails as a prophylactic medication. The treatment data that's available comes from hospitalized patients. It's been available for a couple of months, and it tells us that hydroxychloroquine doesn't help people who are sick enough to be in the hospital.
Okay.
But there's a long ways, a lot of distance between those two studies of people who are in nursing homes, for instance, who may not be very sick. Depends on timing of initiation, and there are a lot of factors we still don't know. So right now, you've got two ends of the spectrum, prophylaxis and very sick people. Hydroxychloroquine is not a benefit, but there's a lot of middle ground where we don't know yet.
What about Zithromax and zinc?
Zithromax, I haven't seen any specific data by itself. I've usually seen it in combination with hydroxychloroquine. Zinc, chromium, other trace metals, and other nutritional supplements. I think there's good reason based on our data from flu and cold that those may help, but they're not helpful even in flu and routine colds if you just start taking it when you've been exposed. Those have to be ongoing nutritional supplements that you've been using for 6 or 8 weeks in advance. So you start that if you're going to use that, you know, but well before the flu season. So then your body is tuned up to be defensible.
What about nitric oxide?
Nitric oxide is an ongoing study, and I'm not an investigator on that study. I'm not aware of any published data on its outcomes yet.
Yeah. Okay. And now, what about steroids as frontline treatment? At what point would those be initiated, and how is that helping?
Yeah. So early on, we were very cautious about steroids. There is recent data that dexamethasone, particularly a long-acting steroid, may be beneficial, especially in hospitalized patients. Whether to use steroids in the outpatient setting is still unsettled, at least in the data that I've looked at. And steroids, if you need them for other things, say you have asthma and you get a reactivation with COVID, it's okay to use steroids. But we would, at this point, still are not recommending steroids as a de novo treatment for COVID infection.
Okay. Dr. Yurochko, let's talk a little bit about vaccines and trials. People want to know, when's there going to be a vaccine for the coronavirus? I know there's a number of different companies all working on their version. So do you all expect a vaccine soon? And can you give our listeners an update on the current trials that are underway? I believe there's a couple, two or
I'll
three
start,
or more.
And then I'll let Dr. Vancheri finish with one of the ones for local. So obviously, there's a number of companies, as you hinted at, that are making vaccines. All the available data from the big three or four at this point are very positive as far as in the limited trials. And I think that's very encouraging from those three different companies. There are more, or there's additional larger companies putting efforts into this that at least the limited data I've seen is also encouraging. There's many different issues when we think about this. Obviously, numbers are in smaller numbers of people that they've tested, encouraging as it may be. If we make one, it would certainly be the fastest vaccine made. You know, the quickest ones we have are 4 or 5 years. We would have one in really under a year.
What do you think about that? I mean, there's almost like a race or a rush to produce a vaccine, does that suggest that perhaps the vaccine won't be quite as effective as if we had one that was developed over a longer period of time? I mean, do you think that a fast one is necessarily the best one?
So, those are questions that are obviously out there. And I know the FDA set about a 50% efficacy as sort of a baseline. And I think when you look at most of what people are hoping for is that the first vaccines released would probably, and again, without knowing, we just don't know, we'll probably have a lower efficacy. And as we go on, there'd be higher efficacy. That does not mean it's a bad vaccine, nor that it's going to be a problem. It just may not work as well. It may work great. We just don't know. But I think in the context of a pandemic, you always have to think of things differently than if you have a childhood illness that's rarer, that we want to have a vaccine, you can safety test it for many years. Again, you know, when smallpox eradicated in 1976, you know, there were as high as 30% mortality. There was a different approach when you have higher, you know, something like a pandemic than something that's not a pandemic. And so these all go into that, you know, and in addition, we also have to think of, even if we get one that works in November, December, you have to ramp it up to make enough levels to get it to where it can be. So when you think about all that, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Vanchair in just a second, we also have to realize we may hit a home run, but it may take a while to ramp up. And that's why most people have guessed that you would be, you know, 2021 later part for really enough max vaccination to get larger parts of the population. And then my own personal beef is the fact that probably only half of the people in the country may even get the vaccine. And we have, what, 330 million people. So you are talking 168 million people that may not be vaccinated, still leaving a large number of potential naive hosts. And
so much for herd immunity.
Yeah. Exactly. And I have my uncle worked with Jonas Salk on the polio vaccine. So I sort of, I guess, have a little passion for vaccines. But I know you want to hear about a potential local one. So I'll let Dr. Vanchary go for that. So I think we're very encouraged. And there's a lot of positive news that the early trials work. They make antibodies, good levels of potential ones that would be expected to work from, you know, all other aspects that we know about the other coronaviruses. So I think, you know, glass, we look at it as glass half full at the very least.
Okay. So Dr. Vanchary, what can people look forward to here locally?
Yeah. So as Dr. Rutschko said, there are 3-4 hot vaccines that are in trials now. And one is an NIH-sponsored trial. They have 10 or 12 sites throughout the country that they have a vaccine network that they've had for decades, and they're using that network for those trials. The other two lead compounds are commercially produced, one by Pfizer, and the other, Andrew, correct me, is AstraZeneca. Is that the Oxford?
Correct.
Yeah. So the AstraZeneca Oxford product, I don't know a whole lot about. I know they are near to phase 3 trials. And phase 3 means that they've already been through evaluations with dozens up to hundreds of patients to look at safety and how well they elicit an immune response. And the phase 3 trial is designed to look at effectiveness and ask, over time, how well does this vaccine produce an antibody response, an immune response that is protective against the virus? And so
by that time, as you stated, the vaccine has already been found to be safe. And so smaller studies, right.
Right, right. So if we go back to, you know, 15 years ago, when we had our first rotavirus vaccine, we tested it for safety in 3,000 people, and we didn't see anything that was an issue. But once it started going out into the millions of people, there were rare complications that were then identified and that caused people to, you know, rework the vaccine a while later. So with respect to the COVID vaccine, our team at LSU will be a site for the Pfizer vaccine study. We don't have a specific timeline right now, other than that more information will be forthcoming within the next week about if people are interested to participate in that study. And that study has started in a few centers throughout the country. So we're just in the second phase of deployment.
Dr. Yurochko, can you talk a little bit about what makes an mRNA vaccine different than, let's say, a traditional vaccine?
So there's a number of different ways you can make a vaccine, of course. You can use a virus that you mutate through any number of things that ends up being attenuated, so it's not very dangerous. You can, in essence, it's a live vaccine. Example would be the Varivax for varicella zoster. That's a live virus that's put in. It's just a weakened virus. There are some like the papilloma, hepatitis B that's just parts of the virus. And then getting the mRNA, essentially what you're putting in is a nucleic acid that mimics the protein you want your own body to make. So they inject the mRNA, which is, you know, again, a nucleic acid. It's the message. It goes into your own cells. Your own cells then produce the protein that your body's immune response would recognize. And the feeling for that is then you let the body ramp up production of the protein, and you don't have to put, you know, sort of high levels in that context. And then the body then will make, in this case, the mRNA from the Moderna vaccine is against the spike protein, which is on the outside of the virus. And in essence, your own body's making the S protein, the spike protein. Your immune response is recognizing that. And then it's jazzed up to obviously recognize that protein. And if you were then to recognize or come in contact with live virus, get infected, you would hope that your immune response would now see that real virus and attack it and do what your immune response is supposed to do. So the big difference is rather than putting in a protein or a live virus, you're actually putting in nucleic acid in your body, make the protein that then gets recognized by your immune response.
So it sounds like there would be essentially no chance that vaccine could then cause the illness. Because you're
That's exactly correct.
Right. So,
it can have side effects, but yeah, right. It won't cause, it's not going to turn into
People say, oh, you know, you get the flu, you take this vaccine, it's a weakened version, and then I'm worried it's going to give me that illness. But that's impossible with this vaccine, even if it were true.
Give you a viral infection.
Right. Even if it were true, it's just not possible because you're not even getting any part of the virus. But along those lines, it sounds to me with the mRNA vaccine, it would be very, very specific for a particular protein. Does that necessarily make it too specific so that a potential mutation in the spike protein could then render that vaccine ineffective?
So the idea of the mRNA vaccine, this would be one of the first times that this is really done for that. And the broad implications are for really any pathogen, you could immediately sequence the pathogen, pick your target, make an mRNA, inject it. Obviously, that's not what they would just do without appropriate phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials, as you heard from Dr. Vancheri. But the implications for the company is they could really do this with any pathogen. In the context of what you asked, the spike protein has many different epitopes on it that in theory, the immune response should target. So the hope is, and there's no evidence yet, that any changes in the virus would make this vaccine not work. But by the very implication that you could quickly make it, in theory, again, if there was one subtle amino acid change, you could dip that in an mRNA vaccine, remodify it, and add that quickly.
The
theoretic implications of this style of approach.
So it sounds like this is revolutionary in terms of how vaccines are potentially going to be made in the future.
It is. And this has been worked on for a while. I mean, it's not like we just, you know, somebody just thought of this last month and said, let's try this new technique. People have been working on mRNA viruses for a long time, for different pathogens, for Ebola, for Zika virus and others. And so it's just that the timing of this one with COVID-19 hit right when those were ready for prime time. And so we said, go for it. So I think what's fascinating about this virus, this type of vaccine, is that your body actually uses that mRNA to make a protein, and your immune system recognizes that protein's not me. And then chops it up and presents it to the rest of the immune system so you can get an appropriate immune response. And so it's really a neat way to have your body make a piece of the virus, then your immune system says, oh, that ain't me, I'm getting rid of it, chops it up and displays it, and you get a good immune response.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So are all the vaccine trials underway or about to be underway, are they all mRNA vaccines?
No. There's some traditional ways, and each of the companies did their their thing. Moderna, as the name implies, modern, was trying a different approach, and they're staking their reputation on this. And
what about the Pfizer trial? That's
the Pfizer's an mRNA vaccine.
Neat. Yeah. And how about the Russian trial, the Russian vaccine?
Don't know.
Okay. You hear a little bit about the Russians say they have a vaccine, but that's not the traditional route, and I doubt that we're going to be using it. Okay. And so how long would it take to conduct this phase three vaccine trial? How many people would need to be included? How long do you think it would take to confirm its effectiveness and safety before we even got to the point where it would be ramped up and manufactured?
So each of the trials, the Moderna, which is NIH funded, and the Pfizer trial, each will enroll 30,000 people. Those 30,000 Pfizer trial are divided randomly, 1-to-1 vaccine versus placebo. And the duration of time to sort of know efficacy depends on how much COVID activity there is in the community, right? Because what we're going to be doing is asking, do people who've gotten the vaccine have less COVID infections or none compared to those who got a placebo? And we're all blinded. We won't know whether a person got the vaccine or the placebo. That's in a computer until the end of the study. So meeting that time point probably is going to take 6 months, maybe. The enrollment is expected to take maybe 2 months. And by the time that we get to Christmas, we should have really good data on efficacy. The challenging part will be sorting out flu, because we want to make sure everybody gets flu vaccines when they're available so that we can easily, hopefully reduce the amount of flu in the community and then see the preventive effect of the vaccine on the coronavirus.
It's interesting. The Oxford trial is doing a 2-for-1, 66% virus, their product, and 1/3 placebo.
Right. Yeah.
So since you're not injecting the virus or parts of the virus, and you're just basically getting the body to produce a specific protein and chop it up and then present it to the immune system, would one expect there to be less risk of significant side effects associated with this type of vaccine?
It's still uncharted territory to a large extent, but the people who've been in the early studies and the animal studies that have been going on for years tell us, yes, a very good safety profile. Anytime you have an injection, there's going to be a little bit of redness and tenderness at the site. Some people will have can have an immune response to the nucleic acid itself if they're prone to that. But that's not common. And so what we know right now is these are generally considered very well tolerated vaccines with few systemic side effects.
And that hits at what we were talking earlier, that, you know, it's potentially revolutionary in the context that it can be very adaptable, but it had been worked on for really almost half a dozen to a dozen years, going way back. So a lot of these things have been safety tested. It's just the timing was worked now, and obviously these companies can do it. It provides a tremendous flexibility for future vaccines.
So when it does become available, would you anticipate that it would first be given to high-risk individuals before it's made available to the rest of the population?
That's the general plan. And in fact, the recruitment strategy for the studies is sort of encouraging of people who are high risk being in the study. And that's twofold. One is you want them to have protection as soon as possible. And number two, because they're high risk, that is maybe they're a healthcare worker, they're more likely to be exposed. And then you're more likely to meet the endpoint of seeing whether they have infection or not because they have more exposures. So there's a self-fulfilling prophecy maybe to some extent that we'll test them as many high-risk people as we can as long as their immune system is functioning well. So we're not looking for high-risk people who have a weakened immune system like cancer chemotherapy, right? Because they would not be a good candidate to see how well it works. because their immune system may not react as well, right? And they may still get COVID.
So in the meantime, we have the seasonal flu vaccine. Can you make an argument why people should go out and get that vaccine while we're waiting for a COVID vaccine?
So I think the major argument is that, number one, they're both bad diseases. Flu still takes its toll on especially the elderly and the high risk, just like COVID does. And the more we can reduce the flu in the community, we're going to be saving lives. The more we can reduce flu in the community, we can target specifically reducing COVID secondarily, and really having the flu vaccine means less stress on our hospitals, our emergency rooms, and the like to try to sort these things out. We'd really rather like to keep the flu out, be able to use our primary care providers, not overwhelm emergency rooms during the wintertime.
And that's in the end why we're working on a multiplex assay, as I pointed out earlier, to do flu A, B, and COVID in one fell swoop to eliminate some of the points that Dr. Vanceri just made.
So in the meantime, let's say somebody tests positive for the coronavirus, but they're not sick enough to go to the hospital. What advice and recommendations would you give in terms of how somebody should treat themselves at home?
So a few things. One, fluids. Make sure you're getting enough fluids. You want to rest. Let your body heal. Make sure somebody else knows you have the infection who can check on you, because some people get sick very, very fast, too fast that they can really reach out for help. So that's not common, but you just want somebody else to know so they can check on you, and you should quarantine yourself. Even if you're not having symptoms, but you're diagnosed with it because you've been exposed and you have the virus in your nose, you should quarantine. And that goes, I'm telling medical students that. I'm telling teaching my kids in the microbiology course right now about this. And a big shout out to those who've been doing the COVID testing in the community with us. So it's about taking care of yourself, relax, rest, Netflix, whatever you like, and make sure you're well hydrated.
Very good. Well, thank you very much. I want to thank my guests this evening, Dr. Vanceri and Dr. Yurochko, for a very engaging conversation, very informative. And I know that there's a lot more that we could talk about and that we will be talking about in upcoming shows. You can find more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast online at redriverradio.org. You can also find updates on COVID-19 for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on our homepage. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. And thanks to Kermit Poling and Wally Derleth for providing assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for being part of our audience this evening. Tune in next Thursday as we continue our special Health Matters coverage.